Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Well, hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. William Shakespeare's play Richard III is one of his longest plays. The BBC 1982 film version takes about 3 hours and 48 minutes to watch. Now, if you can locate this version of the play, I recommend that you watch it. But again, after you have read the play first, of course. But it does stay very close to Shakespeare's written work and with just a few minor cuts in it. Now, one thing I want to say is, though, even though the play might be long, the play's action goes very quickly. And when you understand the history, which we've been trying to help you with, and the characters, which we've also tried to help you with, it is a really very captivating play. The more I study the history, actually the more I like the play. Now, just to let you know, I'm not going to be able to cover all of the play over the radio airwaves. It would likely take me about 7 programs if we talked about, you know, each act and each scene. So what I would like to do in the next several programs is discuss selected scenes that will help you in your reading. Now, what I've done is I've invited my wife, Deborah, into the studio to help me to do this. With both of us being English literature instructors, it will be as if you're sitting in our own family room with us. We have these kind of discussions all the time. So hello, Deborah. Welcome back to JBL.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
I'm really happy to have you. Well, let's just get started. The first scene that I would like to talk about today is just the opening scene. Now, we know that Abraham Lincoln was a lover of Shakespeare, and when Mr. Lincoln was president, he would attend Shakespeare's plays at the theaters in Washington, D.C. There's even records of some of his letters to these actors, and in one letter to a veteran actor at that time, now his name was James H. Hackett, Lincoln requested, and this is a quote, "I should like to hear you pronounce the opening speech of Richard III. Will you not soon visit Washington again? If you do, please call and let me make your personal acquaintance." Now, that quote was taken from the winter 2012 edition of the American Scholar magazine. Now, it's very interesting to note that Abraham Lincoln wondered if the actors performing Shakespeare actually studied Shakespeare. He believed that the actors that he saw in the theaters, he believed that they did not understand how to properly say Shakespeare's lines, especially in this opening soliloquy of Richard III. Mr. Lincoln knew it should be performed with intense bitterness and satire, and so he would actually school a few of the lectures and actually would repeat it for them so that they knew how to say it. So that would have been really quite an interesting event to hear Abraham Lincoln give this soliloquy. So turn with me now to Act 1, Scene 1, and then Line 1, and let's just open with this soliloquy or this opening scene. This is the only play of Shakespeare's to open with a soliloquy, and it really does reveal to us Richard's character. And I'll just start with line one, and I'll try and do it intense and bitter. So it should read, "Now is the winter of our discontent, made glorious summer by the son of York, and all the clouds that lowered upon our house in the deep bosom of the oceans buried. Now are our brows bound with victorious wreaths, our bruised arms hung up for monuments, our stern alarms changed to merry meetings, our dreadful marches to delightful measures. Grim-visaged war hath smothered his wrinkled front." Now, what Richard is talking about here is he's talking about his brother, which is Edward IV. He's talking about his second ascension to the throne. Now, we cover this in history, so if you're a little bit shy on the history, go back and listen to that program. But Henry VI is now dead, and he was executed by his brother, Edward IV. and the Lancastrians have been massacred and essentially stripped from nearly any having any male claim to the throne of England. And so, so he's talking about this time, and he, and it really is a time of celebration for the York side of this royal family, because they feel, well, they've pretty much wiped out the Lancastrians, and they're just going to have smooth sailing now and just keep the throne to themselves. But we can see here that Richard is really, really not that happy. He's not really that happy with his brother, and he may not even be as excited as you would think. Now, if we just go down, skip down to line 10, it says, "And now, instead of mounting barded steeds to fright the souls of fearful adversaries, he capers nimbly in a lady's chamber to the lascivious pleasing of a lute." So here, he's also talking about his brother again. Now, we know from history that Edward IV was quite a ladies' man. But here, he's talking about him like he's this god of war, and that this god of war is so happy the war's over that now he's got other sports on his mind. And, of course, those sports involved a lot of women other than his wife. So Edward was really very much a ladies' man, which really did get Edward into trouble. Now, Richard's bitterness begins to appear. This is with line 14. But he says, "But I, that am not shaped for sportive tricks, nor made to court an amorous looking glass, I that am rudely stamped, and want love's majesty to strut before a wanton ambling nymph, I that am curtailed of this fair proportion, cheated of feature by dissembling nature, deformed, unfinished, sent before my time into this breathing world, scarce half made up, and that so lamely and unfashionable that dogs bark at me as I halt by them." So this is Shakespeare's genius in writing. And, of course, you know from earlier programs that we've done that Shakespeare doesn't really get it right with Richard's physical deformities. And he's actually wrong here. Richard did have scoliosis, and his spine was turned, but he wasn't this hunched-back toad, as he's often talked about in the play. But Shakespeare may have not gotten his physical form right, but I don't necessarily agree with the revisionist history that about his character. I mean, the revisionist historians want to make him a character, I mean, a kind of like a saint. But I believe that maybe Shakespeare got his character right. And Richard is really a conniving, he's a very deceitful man. And he really is really quite bored with the peace that the Yorks have attained. And he really doesn't even like the peace. And he says this in the next lines. And so it does, I think, just show, you know, Shakespeare does have a genius in, you know, creating a character or creating, you know, how we view a character or how a character reveals himself. So look at line 24 there. It says, "Why, I, in this weak piping time of peace, have no delight to pass away the time." So here, King Richard, or Richard of Gloucester, as we should say at this point, he doesn't like peace. It's boring to him. He thinks there's not enough action. He goes on to say, "Unless to spy my shadow in the sun and descant on my own deformity, and therefore, since I cannot prove a lover, to entertain these fair, well-spoken days." So here, everyone else is excited or relieved that the war is over for at this point. But notice what he says, "I am determined to prove a villain, and hate the idle pleasures of these days. Plots have I laid, inductions dangerous, by drunken prophecies, libels, and dreams." And so here, what really excites him is he likes stirring up trouble. He's plotting against members of his own family now. And again, remember, they've gotten rid of almost all of the Lancastrians. And so now he's actually making trouble for his own family. He says, "Plots have I laid, inductions dangerous, by drunken prophecies, by libels and dreams." In other words, he's telling a lot of lies, and there's a lot of deceit. But notice why he says all this. In line 34, he says, to set my brother Clarence and the king in deadly hate the one against the other. So now Richard of Gloucester is wanting to just stir up war within his two brothers. Of course, his older brother is Edward the Fourth. He is the king. Clarence is also his older brother, and he wants to turn them against each other. And there's only really one reason why he wants to do this, is Richard's basic plot here is to eliminate anyone that can get in his way to stop him from taking the throne. Now, Shakespeare's history here may not be 100% accurate, but I do believe his caricature of this man is really an epic view of human nature in raw form. And it is this nature that's growing ever out of control in our own world today. I mean, human nature in the raw is running amok. And, you know, we can even see it not only in the world's problems, but we can certainly see it at the very center of the current U.S. election. So Richard typifies what happens with human nature when it's just not controlled. And so I'll talk about Richard's villainy in another couple scenes in a few minutes. But Deborah, what do you have for us now?
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about the role of the women in this play. You can see right away that the women are strong and in different scenes, and one of their functions is that they are a contrast to Richard's villainy. They actually are like a moral compass, almost like a moral center of the play. And you can see the contrast because Richard is so obviously a villain, and yet they are the mothers, they are the wives, and they see the problems going on. Another function that they have in the play is to show, in some ways, they show the history and maybe some of the prophecy of the destruction and the suffering going on in the families with the Yorks and the Lancasters. And then, so I wanted to show in this first, it's actually Act 1, Scene 2, we meet Anne. She's Lady Anne. She is the daughter-in-law of the slain King Henry the Fourth. Henry the Sixth, excuse me.
Yes.
I'm sorry, these Henrys get mixed up and all this, so the Henrys and Richards. But was her father-in-law, and her husband was also killed. They were both murdered by Richard, most probably. They all assume it was Richard that did kill them. I'm not sure historically if that's true or not. Did Richard actually kill them?
Well, the thing is we know that the father-in-law, or Henry the Sixth, was killed by the Edward the Fourth, or the his older brother.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely, it was. I forget which battle it was. I think it may have been at the Battle of Towton, is when her husband was killed, and Richard was definitely there. Now, whether Richard actually killed him or not, but you have to understand, these are family members killing family members.
Right.
So these are cousins killing cousins.
Right.
So Richard actually could have done it.
He could, yes.
But if you really understand what's going on with the revisionist history, and I've been just reading Alison Weir's book on The Prince and the Two Towers, and even though it was written in the 90s, she says there's just so many facts out there that show that even, you know, if Richard wasn't necessarily, you know, didn't necessarily have the knife, he was still involved, you know, in some of these murders that went on. So,
yes. Yeah, one of the things she does is at the beginning she is saying all these evil things about, and we assume it's Richard. She says, "Cursed the blood that let this blood from hence." She's looking at the body of. Oh, excuse me. I guess I need to explain that this is where there is a procession coming in with King Edward the Sixth's body, and they're taking it to, I guess, the church.
They're taking it for burial.
For burial, yes. And she's walking with it, and she's mourning, and so she's mourning and saying, curse of the blood that let this blood from hence more direful happy side betide, excuse me, the hated wretch that makes us wretched by the death of these that I can wish to wolves, to spiders, toads, that seems to be a theme, toads, or any creeping venom thing that lives. Toads seems to be a theme throughout this play in regards to Richard anyway. But so she says all these horrible things, and he comes in, and it's kind of amazing because she is really upset and really she seems like she should be, she talks about how wonderful the king was and her husband. And she knows that Richard killed them, but then he actually charms her, and she believes that he actually is repented, and he says it was all because of her beauty, and so she agrees to marry him, which is kind of amazing to me. But it kind of shows, I guess it's meant to show the power of Richard and his evil scheming ways of treating people and getting them to come to his side. So anyway, that's how the scene opened. One of the opening scenes in the play, and really, although I believe her morality, her moral compass might be a little bit weak at that point, she does open the play with the idea of grief and mourning. You know, and that is a big theme throughout the play, is the grief and the mourning of all the mothers and wives.
Yes, well, that the one thing I think we could remember about that this first scene, when we have Richard on the scene, Shakespeare does compress about 13 years of history. So I think actually before the play, I was just reading in one history where, you know, Anne knew him. I mean, they were probably, because they were close in terms of cousins and, you know, the way the royal families work together, they probably grew up together. And I think that from my understanding, now she was married to what I want to say is George's wife was Isabel, her older sister. And so you can see that there's this interfamily relationship. So they probably knew each other. And even though she married into the Lancastrian family. So, but they were still, I mean, they were cousins. It's like you have to imagine some of these big picnics, and they had these big royal affairs. They were probably, you know, would have played together as children. So they knew each other pretty well. So, all right. So let me go on to another scene here, just in terms of the villainous Richard and how, you know, he decided, well, he didn't like peace, so he was going to stir up a lot of trouble. Now, I do want to just go to this next scene with his brother Clarence, and it's right before his execution in the tower. But to set this up right, I think we just have to stay here in Act 1, Scene 1. We can start in line 42 for those of them that have their book. And essentially, what I said at the very beginning, this play really does move along pretty fast. You have to really pay attention to see what's going on. And this is actually, the scene I'm talking about is actually just, I think it's just right after, the scene with Anne. And the brother Clarence is in big trouble with his brother Edward. And he is now being escorted out from the throne by a guard, and he's on his way to the tower. But one of the things we learn is that Richard has been involved in the background. And but he's so deceitful in the way he talks to his brother. So his brother walks out, he's got the guard around him, and Richard says to him, "Brother, good day. What means this armed guard that waits upon your grace?" And then Clarence answers him. He says, "Well, his majesty, tendering my person's safety, has appointed this conduct to convey me to the tower." And then Gloucester says, Richard says, "Well, upon what cause?" And Clarence says, "Because, well, my name is George." Now, and then Gloucester acts like he, or Richard again, Richard of Gloucester, acts like he doesn't know anything about it. But if you remember to the scene I talked about before, he was talking about prophecies, that he was talking about dreams and prophecies and libels and these things. And so what we have to understand is historically, you know, the royalty, they were into prophecies. They were kind of into, you know, all kinds of pagan things, really, if you want to know the truth. And so what Shakespeare has us believe is that Richard set up this prophecy that Edward the Fourth would be usurped by a man's that had the first initial G. His first name had a G. And so, but you have to remember that at this time, you know, and the royalty, I mean, usurpation was like a way of life, and fighting for the throne was a way of life. So they were always worried about, well, who's going to try and take my throne? And so essentially, Edward the Fourth in the play is getting him into the tower because he believes he's going to try and usurp the throne. Historically, there was much more going on, and of course, we don't have time to take care of all that. And then Richard of Gloucester, or Richard III, does say, "Alack, my lord, that fault is none of yours. He should for that commit your godfathers. Oh, belike his majesty has some intent that you shall be new christened in the tower. By what's the matter, Clarence, may I know?" So he's saying, well, maybe what they'll do is they'll just rebaptize you in the tower, and it's not going to be that bad, and they'll just give you a new name. And then Clarence says, "Yea, Richard, when I know, for I protest, as I do not, but as I can learn, he hearkens after prophecies and dreams, and from the crossroad plucks the letter G, and says a wizard told him that by G his issue disinherited should be. And for my name of George begins with G, it follows in his thought that I am he. These I learn, and such like toys as these have moved his highness to commit me now." Why, this it is, then Gloucester says to him, or Richard, says, why it is, when men are ruled by women, 'tis not the king that sends you to the tower. My Lady Grey, his wife, Clarence, 'tis she that tempers him to this extremity. So you can see that Richard is now laying even more of a plot. He's saying, look, this isn't your brother's fault. Why, this is Lady Grey's fault. This is the current queen. This is her fault. She's the one that's stirring all this up against us. And really, it was Richard, supposedly, that was stirring all this up. And so he says, that tempers him to this extremity. Was it not she and that good man of worship, Anthony Woodville, her brother there, that made him send Lord Hastings to the tower, from whence this present day he is delivered? We are not safe, Clarence. We are not safe. And so, you know, it is really, you know, quite sad what's going on here. Now, the thing is what Richard has done, and if we just follow the play, he's really, you know, plotted the death of his brother. Now, let's just skip down to line 106. It says, "We are the queen's abjects and must obey. Brother, farewell. I will unto the king, and whatsoever you will employ me in, were it to call King Edward's widow sister, I will perform it to enfranchise you. Meantime, this deep disgrace in brotherhood touches me deep that you can imagine." So here, Richard III is telling his brother, oh, this is affecting me so deeply. It's emotionally disturbing me that here, because of, you know, Edward's wife, you're being sent to the tower and you might be in danger of your life. And anything I can do, you just let me know. I'll take care of it. And then Clarence goes on and he says, "I know it pleases neither of us well." And then Gloucester says, "Well, your imprisonment shall not be long. Meantime, have patience." And then Clarence does say, "I must perforce farewell." So a guard, takes Clarence onto the tower. Now, listen to how Gloucester, or Richard III, ends this scene. And it is really quite interesting for all of you out there that are reading this. Is one of the ways that Shakespeare really uses Richard III is he talks directly to the audience. And a lot of times in this play, he's really informing us, and he's talking to us. And so if you could see this film, I think you would catch it a lot better. So what Richard III, or Gloucester, turns to the audience and he says, this is his brother Clarence just walked away. He says, go tread the path that you shall never return. Simple, plain Clarence, I do love thee so that I will shortly send thy soul to heaven if heaven will take the present at our hands. And so there it just shows what a villain he is. He says, look, I love you so much, I'm going to have you executed and send your soul to heaven. So can you believe it? That's already time for this program. So next time, we'll continue this discussion. We'll give you several more scenes from the play. I know you'll find what we have to say very interesting. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at jbliterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. The address is facebook.com/justthebestliterature. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.